This is the Takeaway Podcast for Tuesday, September 1st, 2015.
This is the Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick, sitting in for John Hockenberry. Thank you so much for listening. All summer is almost gone. And this hour, we take a look at the demise of the summer job. Fewer teenagers and young adults are saying goodbye to their work friends this week than used to just a couple of decades ago. Where did all the summer jobs go? And Ohio Republicans are mad that their native son, William McKinley, has lost the naming rights to the tallest mountain in the United States. We look at other monuments that have been renamed. And electronic producer Goldroom on his influences from country music to Nirvana. But we start this hour on Europe's struggle to take in a massive influx of refugees from Syria and Africa. That's the sound of hundreds of migrants at Budapest-Kaledi railway station in Hungary demanding to board trains holding tickets and chanting Germany. The movement of tens of thousands of people out of Syria, Libya, and Eritrea into southern Europe has created confusion in European capitals, chaos on the trains and on the roads. 70 refugees found dead in a truck in Austria last week. Europe's most powerful politician, German Chancellor Angela Merkel, is demanding that all EU nations do their part and take in refugees.
What bothers me is that we are seeing this hatred, this atmosphere in our country, and my response to it is emphatic. A clear line must be drawn. There can be no excuses.
One Syrian refugee, Muammar Adel, told the AP he's looking for opportunity.
In all the countries of the world, they're looking at the Syrian people like they are terrorists or they're like bad people. All we want to do is just find a new place that we can learn the language and be a productive citizen and start to work.
Now, unlike some of its EU neighbors to the south, for reasons of history, geography, or both, Austria does not have a lot of experience in coping with mass migrations of this kind. Simona Artna is news editor at Krone Hit, an Austrian national radio station, and she says the movement of refugees is creating traffic jams on the highways and on the rails.
The headline today is are the trains that are going from Hungary to Austria and then to Germany. Yesterday, there was a situation where people were like, oh my God, it's horrific. They are taking security controls. They are producing long traffic jams. That's not good. The police was hunting smugglers, trying to help the migrants. But today, there is a huge movement of kindness, and people want to help migrants to go through Austria and to their goal. At the moment, it seems to be Germany.
Most of the migrants are headed to Germany. Germany has been absorbing up to 800,000 so far. And Chancellor Angela Merkel has been on the political stage there saying that other countries have to do their part. You know, Europe has this long history, especially in the last 30 years, of open borders. Merkel says that those open borders within Europe could be at risk if other countries, presumably like Austria, don't step up and help out with housing these new immigrants. How are people reacting?
Politicians are split because on the one hand, they are asking countries to take more migrants. On the other hand, Germany yesterday, they chartered trains to bring migrants to Germany. Obviously, they are regretting that now because many are going. Nobody knows what the one hand is doing, what the others are thinking.
And now there are calls, of course, for a kind of European summit on how all the European countries within the EU can handle this crisis together, I guess, to get the left hand and the right hand talking to each other. Simona Artney, what is Austria's role in this current crisis moving forward, do you think? It seems to be largely a transit point now for people headed to Germany. If that were to change and pressure were to come on a country like Austria to absorb, 80,000 Syrian refugees or people from Africa, do you think Austrians would be all right with that?
That's a difficult question, Todd, because Austria has a long tradition as a country for migrants, as I said before. But the situation is difficult because people are getting, I would say, aggressive against refugees sometimes, not everybody. Of course, there are many people who like to welcome refugees, but there are also those who might be on the way of the right parties and refuse to help. There are many problems with the camps in Austria. Today in the parliament, they are discussing a new law, and the plan is that the state can force the regional states to take those refugees, to take care of them. Until now, they sometimes refuse to do that. And it reminds me of the situation of Ellis Island in the last centuries. They have to live in tents, they sleep without a bed, they don't have food, people don't have water because they do not know that the water is clean in Austria, you know. So sometimes it's a problem to handle it because government isn't doing anything.
And so now it seems, before we let you go, Simona Artney, that Austria, like so many countries, is confronting now a clash between its idealism, maybe its welcoming of migrants and refugees, and hard political practicality, what to do with them, and the fact that a lot of Austrians, let's be honest, probably, when it comes to it, don't want them.
I think it's going to be a fight for a longer time now, because those who want to welcome them are happy to give some kindness and help them. But I think the group of those who want to help are becoming bigger, and it might be that they are winning.
Simona Artney is news editor at Krone Hit, an Austrian national radio station. Simona, thank you.
Thank you, Todd.
So President Obama continues his three-day Alaska trip today, pushing for a muscular new American presence in the Arctic and also making an impassioned call for action on a warming climate. Now, he'll do that with a backdrop of melting glaciers and flooding villages to drive the point home. But for a lot of people, the point was undermined before the president even left Washington.
I share people's concerns about offshore drilling. I remember the BP spill in the Gulf of Mexico all too well. And that's precisely why my administration has worked to make sure that our oil exploration conducted under these leases is done at the highest safety standards possible. And as long as I'm president, America will lead the world to meet the threat of climate change before it's too late.
That's President Obama speaking in Washington before he left on his Alaska trip. Now, just last week, the administration gave final approval for a big new drilling lease in the Arctic. It allows Royal Dutch Shell to drill for oil in the Arctic's Chukchi Sea off of Alaska's northwest coast for the first time in decades. And even without a drop of oil found, the Shell group is believed to have spent more than $7 billion making preparations for this venture. And many Alaskans anticipate seeing a big chunk of that investment in their local economies. Joining me now is Dan Dicker. He's author of Shale Boom, Shale Bust, The Myth of Saudi America. Hi, Dan. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Todd. How are you?
I'm great, thanks. You know, Dan, Shell bid over $2 billion on this Chukchi Sea lease in 2008. They're believed to have spent more than $7 billion on undersea exploration in the area. That's a lot of money. What's at stake for Shell and the other companies here on the northern coast of Alaska?
Well, Todd, you have to understand that oil companies need to grow to survive, and that means growing production to survive. And all the oil companies have to do that in one way or the other. Shell, for some reason that really is unfathomable to me, but has thrown its lot in to a large degree in the Arctic. And as you say, they've spent $8 billion. They'll spend another $1 billion this summer with their project in the Chukchi Sea. And they're going to look for what is an enormous potential amount of oil that they can drill for decades to come. So this one well that they're going to sink and the results of that are a very, very big deal for Shell.
So the U.S. Geological Survey says that 26 billion barrels could be under the floor of the ocean there. Give us a sense of how big a deal that is in terms of American production, American dependence, the American economy.
Yeah, it's another source. It's a very serious source. But again, what you have to remember about oil exploration is that potential barrels compared to recoverable barrels is the crapshoot of all oil companies. So when someone talks about potential barrels in the Arctic in total, they're talking about close to 200 billion barrels of oil. I've seen estimates up to 500 billion barrels of oil. And again, you say that there are 30 billion barrels, or that's the U.S. Coast Guard says that there's potential of 30 billion barrels where Shell is drilling right now. But what is potential and what Shell will ultimately recover are two very, very different things. And all the work that Shell has done to try and understand how much of that oil will be recoverable so far means very little until they actually get into the ground. It's sort of like exploratory surgery. You can think of it that way. I mean, sometimes you just don't know till you get there. And that's really what's going to happen later this fall.
Dan Dicker, we've been talking about the dilemma that's inherent in this drilling during President Obama's trip to Alaska and the Alaskan dilemma. Climate change is real there. The president will stand on melting glaciers. He will go to villages that are flooding, as I said before. At the same time, Alaskans are dependent on drilling. They want the drilling. They want the jobs. They get checks from their government through oil companies, from royalties once a year. What does this mean for Alaskans, an offshore oil rig or two? Big time jobs, or do the jobs fly in from somewhere else?
No. It's very, for the local economies in Alaska, it's a very, very big deal. I mean, you can witness what happened in various areas in North Dakota when Bakken drilling took off 3 years ago, and you saw not only the number of really, really good paying jobs. These are not Walmart jobs. These are not McDonald's jobs. These are very, very high paying middle class jobs for drillers, for rig workers, for physicists, for engineers. The housing that needs to be built to support this kind of operation. I mean, in all ways, it's a real boon. It will be a real boon to the local Alaskan economies. So this makes a big difference, and the Alaskans will be very much in favor of this, despite whatever ecological, environmental impacts it might have.
And the ecological and environmental impacts are critical here for a lot of people. We've heard a great deal of criticism that these areas where the Chukchi leases are remote. If there is a blowout or a spill, it will be very hard to clean up under the ice. A Shell is reportedly taking additional measures that they've been forced to take by the government to protect from blowouts. What is the ecological risk here over and above normal drilling because of the remote nature of this lease?
You know, I'm on the other side of this fence, and I'm very much a liberal. I'm very much an environmentalist from an oil standpoint, from a person who knows a lot about the oil industry, spent my whole life understanding the financial oil industry, and I do not see major differences in terms of the environmental impacts or the dangers of Arctic drilling as opposed to other drilling. I mean, we've seen how horrible drilling offshore can be in places that are very domestic and known to us, like the Gulf of Mexico during the Deepwater Horizon blowout in 2010. I do not see Arctic drilling as significantly more difficult or dangerous or deadly or difficult as we saw in the Gulf of Mexico or anywhere else. The environmental risks are real. They are risks that are inherent in all deep water drilling, and they will be inherent in Arctic drilling. But this idea that because we're going someplace that's unspoiled and wilderness has a deeper impact or a more difficult problem in terms of climate change, I think is a canard and untrue.
Dan Dicker, thank you.
Thank you, Todd.
Dan Dicker is author of Shale Boom, Shale Bust, The Myth of Saudi America. Welcome back to The Takeaway. Todd Zwillick with you. And I have a question. How did you spend your teenage summers? Maybe like all the kids in my town, you worked at an amusement park.
Can you give me a t-shirt, please?
Here, I have a resume. I don't know if you still want to take a look at it.
James, am I pronouncing that right? James?
James?
Yeah. Okay, by accepting this t-shirt, you are...
hired.
Maybe you were a counselor at sleepaway camp.
Andy, are you going to clean that up?
Oh, yeah. I will. I don't have time right now.
Clean it up and come to my office for the meeting.
God, that sounds familiar. How about the all-important informal economy of the American kid, the banana stand?
Two sticks and extra chocolate. Is it Mardi Gras? What are you charging for that?
He doesn't like to discuss money.
I don't like
money.
To discuss money.
What does that mean? You don't pay for it?
A Bluth banana? No, I hadn't planned on it.
Now, summer jobs like the one made famous by Arrested Development's George Michael Bluth there, they're in decline by a lot. According to the Bureau of Labor Statistics, the number of teens and young adults looking for employment declined steadily over the 90s and the 2000s. It's only now leveling off. In 1989, 8 in 10 American kids had official summer jobs, the paycheck kind. Today, it's only 6 in 10. That's a big drop. There are those who are quick to call the youth of today lazy compared to last generations, but for some young adults, it's just not that simple. And for those who can't find or won't find a summer job, they might be missing out on learning an important set of skills that come along with that very first gig. Joining us now, Sarah Bird Sharp. She's co-director of Measure of America, a research nonprofit studying well-being in the United States. Welcome, Sarah.
Thanks for having me.
And Sarah, youth unemployment you found is an important part of well-being. Are American kids missing out on something important here?
Absolutely. So we are, as you said, we're interested in well-being and measuring well-being, and we tend very much to talk about well-being looking at money metrics, and we're really focusing on people metrics, what you know people are doing. And one really fundamental measure of that is how kids are doing in their transition to adulthood. And so we're looking a lot at kids' employment and kids in school, and particularly at a population of kids who are doing neither. We call them disconnected youth.
Sarah, why are so many millions of kids not working now when they used to? Why has this number dropped off?
Well, I would say the summer employment issue is really a lot to do with structural changes in our economy. So there are fewer low-wage jobs, you know, temporary low-wage jobs than there used to be, partly because some of those jobs have gotten automated and the economy is changing. I think school year is getting longer in some cases, and so there's less time to have a job. I think that, you know, definitely youth employment in the long term is declining.
Now, the recession, of course, is part of this. Everybody has fewer jobs. That's easy to understand. But these declines, like I said, they started way before the recession. American kids just aren't going for jobs the way they used to. Structural changes in the economy, but the attitude of kids themselves, are people now going for resume builders, internships? You know, I'm not going to get ahead flipping burgers for the summer. I need to go get a job at the accounting office. Has that changed?
I think that's a piece of it. I mean, I think there's a bunch of factors that are both because kids are making different decisions than they used to and also because of the economy. I wouldn't say it's because kids aren't interested in working over the summer at all. I think that the interest pretty much remains the same.
So what are they missing out on specifically? What types of skills? Look, paycheck, obviously, learning to deal with your boss, sure. What do we know about what kids are really missing out on, whether they can't find work or just don't because they'd rather do something else? What's the consequence here?
Yeah, I would say the research that we've been focusing on is kind of the hardcore kids who try and who wish they could find jobs but are unable. And those kids really struggle. And, you know, one of the things they're missing out on is a sense of purpose, a place to go every day. And that, you know, as a starter is really a difficult situation. And kids who don't have that experience, it can really sow the seeds of hopelessness for them that last for a long time. And it can also sort of arrest their possibility of starting to build a network, a professional network, having mentors who care about them and support them, having somebody every day who's giving them guidance. And so these kids who we've been looking at, these disconnected youth, are really at a serious disadvantage.
Yeah, well, that's interesting. I mean, what do we know specifically from your research about how searching for a job at 16 and not finding it, for example, or 17 or 18, affects, you know, performance in school or getting into college or the quality of that first full-time job when you're 22 or 24? There has to be a knock-on effect, I assume.
What we found in our most recent calculations is that there are 5.5 million kids today in the United States who are in the 16 to 24-year age range who are neither working nor in school. That's like bigger than the population of 30 states. So that's too many kids. And the majority of those kids come from poor households. They tend to be low-income minority kids. And those are the kids that we're really targeting in our research to understand where they live, what are the challenges they're facing, and what are some of the solutions.
Okay, so what do we know then about the dollar spent on investment, whether it's a summer youth employment program? There's a big one in Washington where I'm from. People are comfortable with a big government program in the district like that. It's popular. But it may be a corporate internship program. It may be a nonprofit. All different ways to get kids out of idleness, if that's what they're doing, and onto a track.
I mean, I would say that the cost of these kind of programs is peanuts compared to the cost of not doing it. So we're paying already in terms of incarceration costs and Medicaid costs and public assistance. We might as well pay in terms of good programs and good schools. It actually costs less to prevent kids from, you know, dropping out of high school and being disconnected than it does to pay for the crisis, the full-blown crisis that happens when we don't.
You can go to our website at thetakeaway.org and see the steady decline of youth employment. There's a chart there that is actually overwhelming to the eye. There is no doubt way fewer American kids are working in the summer than used to. Sarah Bird Sharp is co-director of Measure of America. Sarah Bird Sharp, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
Pope Francis has announced today that he will allow Roman Catholic priests to absolve women who have had abortions if they seek forgiveness. It's all part of his Jubilee Year of Mercy plan, a special year for Catholics to receive blessings and pardons from God beginning on December 8th. Here with more is Father James Bretzky. He's professor of moral theology at Boston College School of Theology and Ministry. Father James, welcome.
Thank you very much.
What does it mean to have a one-year break, I suppose, in the church's condemnation of abortion? Certainly not a break in their condemnation, but allowing priests to absolve women who've had abortions. What does this mean practically?
Well, what it means practically is he's giving every priest in the world now the delegated power to absolve this sin. Under current church law, the power is given to bishops and some priests that bishops delegate, but now every priest has it, and that's going to make it much more public and much more available to people who have suffered an abortion. And he says in it that he really wants to extend the forgiveness of God.
That's practically. Let's talk theologically for a moment, because to an outsider and maybe to a lot of insiders too, it's a little hard to grasp that there would be a one-year Jubilee year delegation of forgiveness so that more women who committed this sin in the eyes of the church could be absolved. But then after that, it's back to an unforgivable sin. How does that work?
Well, that's not correct. It's not an unforgivable sin. Let's use an analogy in the sense of business. If you wanted to open a checking account, maybe you had to go to the main office. And now what he's doing is saying you can go to any ATM, any grocery store, any place where there is a representative of the business. So that's what he's really doing, is he's giving this not just to the branch offices or the main offices, he's giving it to every priest wherever that priest is.
Doesn't this mean, though, in practical terms, maybe even political terms, Father James, that after this, the church can't go back? Is this going to be the practice of the church as long as Pope Francis is the head of the Holy See?
Well, he as Pope can delegate this power to priests permanently if he wishes. Maybe he, in fact, will do this. It's hard to say. This could be a start.
This politically, of course, in this country, as you know, you're from Massachusetts, Father James, is going to have reverberations. We've had political episodes in this country, of course, where certain bishops or archbishops have said they wouldn't give someone like, you know, John Kerry communion because he supports abortion rights. Same for Democratic leader Nancy Pelosi, a Catholic. We've seen these episodes before. Pope Francis is, of course, coming to the United States in September for a high-profile visit to the Congress. This is going to get some blowback probably from Republicans who are also Catholic.
Well, if they're good Catholics, they have to follow the Pope and the gospel of Jesus Christ on forgiveness of sins. So I think what the issue is, a misunderstanding, in fact, of what is church law and church practice in this case. The John Kerry and Nancy Pelosi case is really a quite different issue. But certainly this Pope is putting the accent on forgiveness, on mercy. And you're correct, certain bishops and priests, regrettably, have put the accent in the past on punishment and excommunication. And I think the Pope is trying to say we need a different stress, need a different approach.
And even with that accent changing, I mean, this is really a glaring example. A lot of people would have thought the accent changing on gay rights or on any other issue was more likely than abortion. This is a big deal.
Well, it's a big deal, but I don't think it should be misunderstood. He is not saying that abortion is no longer a sin.
Of course.
That's a key point that I don't know if everyone's going to understand that. What he's saying is this is a real sin. And we need to give the power to deal with that real sin to as many priests as possible so that everyone who needs to have this reconciliation can obtain it easily in a sense of mercy and forgiveness. And that's what he's stressing.
Father James Bretsky, thank you so much.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Father James Bretsky is professor of moral theology at Boston College School of Theology and Ministry. LA-based DJ, producer, songwriter, and bandleader Josh Legg, widely known as Gold Room, isn't exactly faithful to the gods of electronic music. He's a confessed Bob Dylan addict. He counts Nirvana as a major influence and tries to use as many natural instruments as possible in his songs, which he's been releasing under the Gold Room name since 2011. He now tours with a full band and singers using samples, but samples as more of a skin and not a skeleton for his tracks. But if Gold Room is old school in his approach to recording, he's definitely on the front edge of technology. He released his latest EP over Snapchat.
It's much more akin to, say, if it was in the 90s and an artist released a music video on MTV and that was the only place you'd get to hear their new song. These videos only lived on Snapchat for 1 week, and then they disappeared forever until they ended up on YouTube. And so on Monday, you were delivered the first video, and then on Tuesday, the second one. And the thing that was exciting to me about it was that people who were watching it really wanted to know what happened next. And so they had to come back the next day to find out. And I think that there aren't very many things besides serialized TV shows that draw people in towards wanting to know what happens next in that way.
It's clear that Josh thinks pretty deeply about his work and about how it's released. He sat down and told us about his process.
I tend to believe very strongly that the song is the only thing that matters. And, you know, if I can't pick up an acoustic guitar and play you something that I've written and have it work in that setting, then it probably doesn't deserve to have all the bells and whistles placed around it. You know, the song is sort of the house. The accoutrement that you put around it is sort of what you fill the house with and how you paint it, but it doesn't change the bones of the house. I'm closer to like a country musician or an Americana musician that just happens to be surrounding my country songs with electronic elements. You know, my heroes in songwriting are, you know, Tom Petty, or to use a more current example, Ryan Adams. I tend to really love the things that Tom Petty does in his music, where he's not exactly a storyteller, but he's talking about emotions that everybody can relate to. And I think anybody can relate to, you know, his song Free Fallin'. I wanna glide down over Mulholland. I wanna ride through name in the sky. I'm gonna free fall out into nothing. I'm gonna leave this world for a while. Now I'm free. And I try really hard to write songs like that, and if I can ever write my own Free Fallin' at some point in my life, then, you know, I will be very happy. Guided by the light, on the trade winds through the night, I'm gonna keep you in my sight. I see you, I see you. I didn't realize that I was becoming a producer per se, but my cousin gave me a Tascam 4-track recorder when I was 12. From that time, I had started to write songs on acoustic guitar, and he just gave this to me so that I could record them, and I immediately became pretty fascinated with how to make those recordings sound as good as possible. And, you know, little did I know that I was really learning how to become a producer at that point. My biggest concern with the direction that electronic music is moving is that there seems to be a real lack of focus and belief that songwriting is still an important part of the process. And in my world, there's a lot of people who just sort of create and a beat on their computer or something like that, and then a different songwriter comes in and sings over it, and then that becomes the song, even though the artist doesn't necessarily have much of their heart or soul, or there isn't much meaning in the release. And so for me, I like to have all of the electronic elements at my disposal, and I certainly enjoy that process. But if I can't strip it back and play the song on the piano and have it work, then it's not a good enough song, and it probably won't mean much in 10 years. For some people, music is a real internal and exploratory thing, but for me, music has always been an extremely escapist thing. When I was a kid, I think I always used music as a way to escape where I was and to try and take me somewhere warmer. And you know, my other life's passion is in boating and sailing. I ran a sailing school for a few years, and I've done a lot of offshore passages, and I have a real love for the ocean. And when I was a kid, I think I would always listen to music and imagine being in a tropical locale or something like that. And I think that because I fell in love with music from that angle, I've always made music coming from the same place. I've been writing music my whole life, but I started releasing music in the late 2000s. And at the time, the only way to find listeners was to have blogs on the internet write about you. You know, as an independent musician, that was the only way to sort of get tastemakers' ears. And at the time, we didn't have any way of streaming music for free, so we were actually giving blogs our music for free, which they would then give to their readers for free. So you could just have downloads of MP3s. And so, you know, when the advent of SoundCloud came around and other streaming services like Spotify and now even social networks are getting involved in this kind of thing, we have developed ways where you can listen to people's music for free, but you can't necessarily own it or have it on demand exactly whenever you want. So things are actually a lot better now than they were 10 years ago, which is something that I think a lot of people don't realize. In order for me to get a new fan, I generally would have to give them an MP3, and they wouldn't have to give me anything in return, whether it was something monetary or some connection where I would have the ability to tell them about a show or reach them again in any way. And now in general, if somebody wants to listen to my music, or if they want to actually buy something of mine, or even if I'm giving them something, they sort of have to give something back to me, whether they're liking my Facebook page or following me on SoundCloud or paying me for an MP3. And so now at least I have the opportunity to say, you know, well, if you don't want to pay me for my music, at least I can tell you when I'm going to be in your town, and hopefully you can come to my show.
Gold Room's latest EP is called It's Like You Never Went Away, and it's available now. And here's something to take with you today, a summer job with a great lesson.
This is Jennifer Kenny in Portland, Oregon. In my early 20s, I worked for a woman who owned her own public relations firm, and it was the best summer job I ever had because I saw firsthand how a confident, competent woman not only runs a business but meets with colleagues, government officials, clients, and general members of the community. I learned so much about poise and outreach and just inner self-confidence and how that translates to success. Best lessons I could have learned as a woman going into the professional world.
Share your summer job story at thetakeaway.org. You can call us anytime at 877-8-MY-TAKE. Tweet us at thetakeaway. You can reach me on the Twitter at any time. Ask me anything at Todd Zwillick. Thank you so much for listening. I am Todd Zwillick, filling in for John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
Support for The Takeaway comes from the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia. The Takeaway's resilience reporting is supported by the Rockefeller Foundation. For more, go to rockfound.org.
PRI, Public Radio International. On Notes from America, we have conversations with people across the country about how we can truly become the nation that we claim to be. Each week, we talk about race, our politics, education, relationships, usually all of them, because everything's connected. And you, our listeners, are at the center of those conversations. I'm Kai Wright. Join me on Notes from America, wherever you get your podcasts.